Well, hello everyone. This is my election 2024 post-mortem. Welcome. It's taken me a little while to get this up because I was part of the Lotus Eaters election coverage, which was quite a phenomenal success. At one point there was, across all platforms, over 50,000 people watching, just 30,000 just on Rumble alone, which made it the biggest online broadcast anywhere on the internet, basically, apart from the BBC. So they literally got higher numbers, the Lotus Eaters, than Sky News, Channel 4, ITV, which is really quite amazing. If you haven't watched that, we had a lot of fun, actually. I was on five panels over the course of the night, including one with Ed Dussum, which was absolutely hilarious. I'm actually hoping that they cut out the individual panels so you'll be able to watch them, you know, as kind of one-off shows. But if you don't catch anything else, try to watch the hour with Ed Dutton. It was a surreal and hilarious experience. Also, I formed an unlikely partnership with Count Dankula, who was also wearing a Hawaiian shirt, over the course of the evening, which a lot of people were amused by because they thought it was quite an unlikely partnership. Anyway, in this video, I'm going to be going through the reasons why Zero Seats, the big campaign that I led and many, many, many other people across the internet took part in, failed. As I said, anything above 100 seats, and the Tories managed to get 121 seats, is a zero seats loss. We did not win that campaign. And I'm going to go through four reasons why I believe the zero seats campaign failed. I'm also going to talk about what this means going forward. What does it actually mean that we failed in our grand quest to get the Tories as close to zero seats as possible? I'm also then going to look at what the results mean for the Tories now going forward, and also what they mean for Labour going forward, because even though this was a large landslide win for Labour, as I'm sure you're all aware, things are not hunky-dory within the Labour Party. You know, it's not as clear-cut for them as it may appear. So let's make a start. So the big question then, why did Zero Seats fail? And I think it really boils down to four main reasons. The first reason, and I'm sorry to say this, is Peter Hitchens. Now, you may think that Peter Hitchens is a non-factor or is not an important voice. Actually, he is. His column in the Mail on Sunday is read by the key demographic that prevented zero seats from happening, namely boomers, conservative boomers, Tory loyalists who are, you know, in their 60s and 70s. We online, and people like people who watch this channel or people who watch likes of the Lotus Eaters and so on, don't reach that demographic in the sort of numbers that would have made a difference. You know, we have some influence, but the influence is over, you know, Zoomers, Millennials, possibly some Gen Xers, but we do not reach that core demographic. Peter Hitchens does. And Peter Hitchens, for many, many years, has essentially been, you know, calling for zero seats for the Tory party, for the destruction of them. But in this election, he decided that, no, you know, Labour are too bad to allow into power. And basically, he was part of a fear campaign saying, you know, really, we do anything to keep Labour out, which is essentially vote Tory. Now, this is baffling because it was Peter Hitchens who came up with the idea that the two parties, that is Labour and the Conservatives, are like two zombies leaning against, propping each other up, Okay. Now, if you take that analogy to its logical conclusion, you destroy one of the zombies and the other one would collapse because they help each other. There is a dialectic. And Hitchens knows this. So it really is quite astounding that at the hour of decision, he essentially abandoned his post. And I think, I'm afraid to say, Peter Hitchens let us all down. He let everybody who's on the right in this country, or anybody who cares about this country, or is in any way conservative, at the hour where we had the chance to destroy the Tory party, Hitchens basically, when he could have made a difference, and if you think that his column is not influential, you are mistaken. Especially with that demographic, you've got to understand that people over a certain age are genuinely influenced by newspapers in a way that younger people are not. Younger people are influenced by, social media personalities, YouTube, likes of me, for example. But older people are influenced by, the mainstream media, newspapers, legacy media, things like that. And Hitchens is arguably the leading voice in this country for the conservative right. Okay. That is why I am saying that he is reason number one. If Hitchens had got on board with zero seats rather than counter signaling zero seats, I don't know how many thousands of voters that would have translated into, but it would have made a difference. And it would be a mistake to let Hitchens off the hook. Okay. Second, and also what's disappointing is that this morning, on the 5th of July, so that was yesterday morning, by the time you'd be watching this, he posted on his Twitter feed just a screenshot of him saying, "I told you so, I told you so." And that's really the only reason why he adopted his position of doomsmongering about how bad the Labour government is going to be, because he always wants to be the guy who says, "I told you so," which is basically just an ego thing. What Hitchens should have done is stuck to his principle and, become the true leader of zero seats, because it was his idea in the first place. Second reason that zero seats failed was due to a last-ditch Boris Johnson blitzkrieg, where in the last, literally the last 2 days of the campaign, he came back from holiday and, as you can see, it says in the Daily Mail, dramatically intervened in the election, urging voters to stop the Labour supermajority and what he was calling Starmageddon. Now, on July the 3rd, I happened to go to a town. I had to pick up a few things before, the election stuff. And I looked over all of the newspapers. Boris Johnson was on the front of, I would say, at least half. I counted 4 newspapers he was on the front of out of 8 in the stand. All of them with this kind of huge fear project. And it worked. I'm afraid to say it worked. And I have seen people, real life boomers, who were persuaded by this intervention by Johnson. Again, those of us who are online or savvy or a bit younger, we're used to being sceptical about the mainstream media. The older generation are not like that. So tactics like this genuinely work. So Johnson was a huge factor. And probably the intervention by Johnson swayed even more people than Hitchens. I mean, Hitchens has got a very influential readership within the kind of conservative core, right? The party membership. Johnson obviously has wider appeal than Hitchens, and I think that made a dramatic difference as well. The third reason why Zero Seats failed is simply because Keir Starmer, as a man, lacks charisma. He's very boring. And so in this election, he did not, even though there's many comparisons to the Tony Blair election of 1997, unlike Tony Blair, who was a likable and charismatic kind of, he had a star presence back in 1997. Starmer has almost no crossover appeal. And he won this election with a very small number of votes, actually. It was only 9.7 million people voted for Labour in this election, even though that translated into 411 plus seats. They had a very technically proficient, efficient campaign where they, you know, they were playing the game that they needed to win, which is seats, not total number of votes. I heard the Lord Mandelson talking about this as a deliberate strategy that they pursued during this election, and it worked. I mean, what I would liken it to is Jose Mourinho tactics in football. You know, you don't always need to play pretty football. Sometimes you need to win ugly. And Labour, basically, they won ugly this time. They just they picked up what they needed to do. Tight seats sometimes. You know, they didn't care if they were winning it because Reform were taking votes off the Tories. They didn't care if they were only winning it by slender margins, you know, 500 votes. I saw one seat which was won by 15 votes. So, you know, they won by playing a lot of boring football, if you want to make the analogy. Tight, you know, a 1-0 win or a 2-1, you know, last minute header, etc. But because of that, Starmer didn't really pick up that many cross voters. There weren't many Tory Labour switch voters in this election. And in fact, he lost a lot of the Labour base. He got far fewer votes total than Jeremy Corbyn, which shows that the Labour voters were not enthused to vote for Labour in this election. Now, that doesn't matter in terms of the seats. As I just said, you know, they played to win the game in front of them. But what it did mean is that because there was that lack of enthusiasm for Labour and the win was purely an anti-Tory win, Zero Seats failed to materialise because there's still enough people who feared Labour more than Tories, essentially. And I think a more charismatic leader than Starmer would have pulled more people across. And the fourth and most important reason that Zero Seats failed was because of the eternal boomer. Now, when I was on the Lotus Eaters coverage, I said at one point that, you know, we, you know, all of us pushing for Zero Seats, we fail to account for a force that is stronger than 4,000 years of accumulated wisdom, and that is the unlimited selfishness of the boomers. Not content with destroying our entire society, they, you know, their quadruple lock pension, you know, they were probably enthusiastic about the national service stuff as well. I mean, not content with what they've done, they couldn't even help us out here. It was the boomers, more than anyone else, who prevented Zero Seats. And I mean, I speaking of Jose Mourinho, you know,
I prefer really not to speak. If I speak, I am in big trouble, and I don't want to be in big trouble.
So what does all of this mean, that Zero Seats failed? Well, first and foremost, the main reason for doing Z Receipts, from my perspective, was to break political kayfabe. If you're unfamiliar with kayfabe, it's a term from pro wrestling. You know, Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant were really friends backstage. They were both working for Vince McMahon. They weren't really enemies. They were pretending to fight. And political kayfabe is the idea that the two parties are deadly enemies, whereas in fact, they're kind of in cooperation. And Lord Mandelson, it was interesting. When I was driving back from Swindon, I had BBC Radio 4 on, and he said, this is a direct quote, "A good government requires an effective and robust opposition." And effectively, Mandelson was happy that the Tories were not completely wiped out, as per Blair in 97, right? And he was gloating, basically, that kayfabe had been saved. So that kind of, I found that particularly upsetting. Yes, so political kayfabe is alive and well. We are not going to get the end of that. We would have if the Tories had been down on 60, 50 seats, something like that. But it was not to be, I'm afraid. It also means that just like T-1000, the Tories get to live to fight another day. And, you know, we talked, didn't we, about the double tap, that the Tories are not going to stay down easily. Zero seats wouldn't even be enough. Even when they were down, we'd need to double tap them so they stay down. That's not going to happen now, because with 121 seats, 121 MPs, they're going to reform. And they'll be back, and they'll be the government again. You just can't keep them down. That is why the Tories are the most successful political party in history. Because even when it looks like they're down and out, they pull these stunts, you know, the last minute Boris Johnson intervention, every trick in the playbook they will, just to survive, to live to fight another day. And this is part of their calculation. That's why I was stressing the zero seats was so important. But as I said, we were betrayed by Hitchens and the boomers, unfortunately. And obviously Boris Johnson decided for some reason to help Sunak, who, let's not forget, knifed him in the back. So there we are. So what is the problem for the Tories now? Well, there's a huge problem that the Tories have, which is that the two sides of the party, essentially the One Nation Tories, as represented by Jeremy Hunt here, or the Wets, if you want to put it that way, and the National Conservatives, or the populist wing, or what some of the press are calling even Faragist, that's a new term that they're using now, wing of the party, as represented by Suella Braverman, just don't see eye to eye on anything. The likes of Jeremy Hunt, Alicia Kearns, you know, Rory Stewart, Tobias Elwood, the Wets, basically, all of these kinds of characters, they think that the Tory party needs to be even more left-wing, to come even more into the centre ground, and to be a progressive, basically the party they've been for the past 14 years, to double down, to triple down on the Cameron project, okay? Whereas the Suella Braverman wing, or the National Conservative wing, and Braverman said this in her speech, she retained her seat, basically think that they need to outflank Nigel Farage and occupy that ground to win back those disaffected voters who've gone to Farage. And this is a genuine problem for the Tories, because these two visions have very little in common. There's almost no, you know, they talked for many years about the broad church of the Conservative Party. And back in the Thatcher days, you know, the Wets and the Dries, the Dries were the more hardcore Thatcherite libertarians. Well, after Liz Truss, who is now widely seen to have crashed the economy. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it's that is just embedded in the mythology of the country now. She seems to have killed the idea of a kind of small state libertarian Tory party, the Thatcherite wing, dead. Okay, so it's not really a split between hardcore kind of libertarian Thatcherites and more kind of, you know, paternalistic One Nation Tories anymore, which was the old kind of Thatcher Heseltine split. It is more now between these kind of globalist WEF types like Jeremy Hunt and Tories like Braverman, who get it on immigration, who get it on the dissatisfaction in the base of the party, and who want to basically go where Farage has gone. And it's going to be very difficult to see how those two things can come together. I think it's almost inevitable that the Tory party is going to split in two, and that they're not going to be able to mend this. Whether that means the Jeremy Hunt types leaving the party or the Braverman types leaving the party remains to be seen. But basically this has to happen. Either Alicia Kearns joins the Lib Dems or Braverman joins Reform. You know, and it's not just Braverman. She's the figurehead. There are lots of Tories in that boat. Because of the Cameronite tactics of embedding the most left-wing, diverse, you know, SJW-ish types in the safer seats, as per Alicia Kearns, it does mean that of the 121 MPs, more of them are of the Jeremy Hunt, Alicia Kearns stripe than of the Braverman stripe. So it may be easier for the Braverman types to join Reform than it will be for the One Nation types to join the Lib Dems. But let us see what happens. I think it's almost going to be impossible to mend this rift. And, you know, it's an existential fight, basically, for the soul of what the Tory party stands for. There's a chap called David Frost who wrote a very, very strong piece in the Telegraph arguing the Braverman position. I have equally seen articles counter-signalling that in The Spectator and elsewhere, putting over the wet position more. There are two real problems here which seem to me almost impossible to overcome. This is a genuine impasse here, because there's the Reform factor, Farage, basically, who have made it nearly impossible for the Tories to win in traditionally working class areas now, across the Red Wall and the South East and places like Wales. The Tories were wiped out in Wales. I saw Bridgend, which went Tory in 2019, went back to Labour. So all of those seats that Boris Johnson picked up on the back of Brexit in 2019, it's hard to see them ever going Tory again unless they basically join forces with Farage. Or they take Farage's message and don't water it down. So that is a big chunk of seats right there that they lost. They were just wiped out in all of these areas. And Reform took a huge amount of votes from them. I think it was 4 million votes Reform took, basically, from the Tories in this election. So, you know, and in fact, if you combine the Tory vote and the Reform vote, they got more than Labour combined. So, yes, I mean, when they said that the right was split, that is true, basically. But you can see why Reform has happened. Because, well, what was zero seats about? It was the betrayal. first and foremost. You cannot import 6 million people in 14 years after saying repeatedly that you're going to reduce immigration. I mean, it's not just that. They failed on every single other issue as well. I don't want to go back over all the election talking points now. But that, you know, that sense of betrayal is going to be very difficult for the Tories to overcome with basically the white working class. And then on the flip side, the other factor is that the Lib Dems had a huge night, a historic night. I think they got over 70 seats, biggest win for the Lib Dems in a long time, where they took the so-called blue wall, which is nearly the whole of the south of England. You know, it's from all the way, you know, it's from Cornwall all the way to just west of London, to the home counties. All of that is traditional Tory ground, and the Lib Dems cut through it like a knife through butter last night, or the night before. These voters, these kind of all of the voters in those areas, basically, are the British equivalent of what I would, I mean, if I was to make an analogy, it's like the suburban women who find Trump off-putting, right? These sorts of voters are essentially well-off, they're middle class, they're, broadly speaking, neoliberal, NIMBY voters, right? Okay, so that means that they kind of don't really care that much about immigration as long as it doesn't affect them. Not in my backyard, right? They don't care about the woke stuff as long as it doesn't affect them, right? And so, you know, they have this view that they want to stay off culture war issues, they want to focus on economics, and basically, you know, they support green stuff because that basically means not building in their areas. It's all NIMBYism, really. And all of those areas basically went Lib Dem. And it's this pressure from the Lib Dems with these sorts of voters that prevents the Tories becoming more populist. That is the argument that Jeremy Hunt will make. And in fact, I'm sitting in Jeremy Hunt's seat right now. It's Godalming. And I've been keeping an eye on Jeremy Hunt's campaign. He won this seat through, well, he won back this seat through a very defensive campaign. It was a masterclass in defensive campaigning, actually, where he went round little tea shops and coffee shops and took selfies with the locals and had tea and cakes and, you know, went cycling, you know, took selfies with Lycra Man. And, you know, he just about did enough to hold on from the Lib Dem threat in this seat. And likes of Kearns did the same. You know, that's how they keep hold of these seats, by appealing to, you know, the local character of the place, which they protect, okay, which is quite Tory, you might say. But then in the national government, of course, they're woke, they're, you know, globalist and all the rest of it. So it's a kind of neat little trick the Tories pull off to keep hold of these seats. But the argument from the Wets will be that the likes of Braverman and Sunak engaging in the culture war stuff, which they dabbled in, and Boris Johnson, to some extent as well, appealing to populism, put off these voters. Now, the counter-argument to that from the Braverman types will be like, well, hold on a second. Boris won all these seats, and he won the red wall seats. It was only when Sunak was installed that all of these seats fell away. It was only when they went full kind of globalist WEF that you had this disaster. Because Sunak basically couldn't really decide what the party wanted to be. And there was so much fighting between the two wings that they ended up kind of doing neither of them. They didn't go full Cameronite and they didn't go full populist. and it was kind of a fudge in between, and they ended up being the worst of all worlds. Whereas with Johnson, they ended up kind of, you know, Johnson had a populist appeal, but he was still basically a WEF globalist. So he managed to tick both boxes somehow. And it's going to be incredibly difficult for the Tories to go back to that without returning to Johnson, which they may do. And the late intervention of Boris may signal a Boris comeback in the future, because it's very difficult to see any other person who's going to unite these two wings of the party again. Now let's look at the problem for Labour. Now Labour lost a lot of votes from the Corbyn. You know, Corbyn got over 13 million votes, I think it was, in 2017. And he definitely got more votes in 2019 as well than Starmer got here. Only Johnson got a whacking great, like 13.9 million in that election. And so what is the problem for Labour? They've really got two problems, which I am calling the Rainer factor and the Gaza factor. So let's go into both of those now. The Rainer factor is basically that message discipline is going to be rather difficult to maintain with 411 plus unknown MPs. There's a lot of new faces there, and factionalism is bound to break out with that many MPs. I'm calling it the Rainer effect because Angela Rainer, the deputy leader, is definitely to the left of Starmer and is probably more on the Brownite side of the party than the Blairite side of the party. I also notice Ed Miliband is in the cabinet as well. Now, if you know anything about New Labour, the first iteration, there was a big split between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair, which ended up doing in the party, basically, especially after Blair, the Blairites gave way to the Brownites, and then Gordon Brown was a disaster in the 2010 election, if you remember. Now, Starmer's been ruthless in transforming the party into a tight Blairite election-winning machine, you know, a kind of a Jose Mourinho-style outfit, if you want, in political terms. But he is not blessed with the talent that Blair had. And there are serious questions about whether he'll be able to maintain message discipline. How is he going to keep Angela Rayner and people like her from saying stupid left-wing things? Because don't forget, the whole Blairite cell is that the adults are back in the room, they're sensible, they're not going to do anything stupid, they're managerial, they're technocratic. And, you know, what's remarkable is that David Lammy, who, if you remember, was the kind of race-baiting SJW a few years back, has now reinvented himself. He is now the Foreign Secretary, which is a terrifying prospect. But he has reinvented himself as this kind of realist Blairite. He's even declared the Lammy Doctrine. He said, Labour's foreign secretary in waiting on why Britain must adapt to the world as it is, not as liberals wish it to be. I mean, that is basically a direct Machiavelli quote. And it's something that Blair has said. Now, I happen to know that there is a SPAD, a kind of handler that Lammy has, that is writing that stuff on his behalf and basically guiding his hand. The question is, how tight is that Blairite control over the party? And are they going to be able to puppeteer the Starmer iteration of New Labour enough? I know Lord Mandelson has been very close to what's been happening. I know Campbell has been close to what's happening. And we know Blair has been close to what has been happening. But we also know, and we have seen, that unlike in 1997, where he could line up all his cabinet and almost like robots, they just repeat the same sound bites. In the age of social media, where everybody's got a Twitter, we have seen the likes of Jess Phillips, for example, just cannot help running their mouths, saying stupid things, you know, not being able to maintain discipline on the trans issue, for example. So they've got a job on their hands when it comes to this. And if I see it going wrong anywhere for Starmer, it will be this tight discipline, this ruthlessness. It's one thing to do it when you can deselect candidates. When they're actually MPs, it's a lot more difficult to get rid of them once they're in. It's a much bigger process to get rid of an MP once they're sitting there. And factionalism is still going to be a problem. The second factor I want to point to is what I'm calling the Gaza factor. Labour lost as many seats to pro-Palestinian independents in London and the Midlands as the Tories lost to Reform. There were a number of MPs. Now, Galloway lost his seat because they poured a lot of resources into Galloway's seat to get rid of him. And Galloway's kind of always a bit fair weather like that. He kind of drops in for a couple of months, steals a seat, and then he's off again. He often does that. But there is an angry Muslim vote out there who are upset about the Israel-Gaza situation. And several MPs, these friendly-looking chaps here, as well as Jeremy Corbyn, campaigned strongly on Gaza in this election. And they took votes from Labour and they won seats from Labour. These guys are now MPs. Independent Muslims, MPs now. This is a new development. They're calling it a kind of sectarian vote within the country. Now that is a national problem, I would suggest, as well as a problem just for Labour. But it does remain a question. How is Starmer going to triangulate his staunch support for Israel with the increasingly politically organised Muslim minority? That remains to be seen. I ask the question, can Labour now afford simply to write off this demographic? Maybe just Labour just don't even need the Muslims anymore. That's a big question. I would suggest that even though this looks like a stonking great landslide for Starmer, their position is more fragile than it seems, right? If you have a look at the historical vote, Blair was down to these sorts of numbers by 2005, right? But he still won in 2005. In 1997, he won with 13.7 million, okay? Now, don't forget, there's more people in the country now than in 1997. So as a proportion of the total population, I think Labour only got about 19% of the whole country. That's not even though it looks like a strong mandate with over 411 seats, it's not actually that strong. And the media have been pretty adept at pointing this out. The media coverage has not been jubilant. It's not the celebrations and the, you know, effusive praise that we saw in 1997. They were notably subdued, muted. They know, basically, that this is not a thumping great mandate, and there is a legitimacy question over this new Labour government now. So I don't know if Labour are able to just write off Muslims now. So they're going to have to do something to appeal to them. Now, this makes it very difficult. Not just on the Israel question. Don't forget, Labour won this election by tacking right and appealing to those disaffected working class voters by promising to not do woke stuff. They didn't say that, but they presented themselves as patriots. Basically, they draped themselves in the Union Jack. They promised to reduce immigration. Starmer, he wasn't calling Farage racist or any of that stuff. They're extremely disciplined during the campaign. Now, you have an unhappy Muslim minority. So, if Labour respond to that by basically making a big display of pandering to the Muslim population. They then may immediately lose those white working class voters that they won back. Now, I don't know how many of those white working class voters they did win back. I'd have to see the kind of demographic breakdown, which haven't come out yet, of the overall vote. But certainly it would be difficult, I would say, for them to go back to looking like they're pandering to minorities while maintaining this sort of majority in the overall country that they manage this time. So, yes, those are problems that Starmer faces in the future. Let me know your thoughts about this. This was my election post-mortem. I do buy courses at the academic agency. You can still buy them all. I'm working on a Shakespeare course at the moment, Foundations of Shakespeare, which should be out soon, within the next couple of months, hopefully. But in the meantime, Foundations of Writing, Foundations of Logic, Foundations of Rhetoric, the Trivium, that's the best-selling course. Over 4,000 students now have done courses at the academic agency, and that's only growing. So be part of it. Get yourself some of the education that is denied to you at universities today. But most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, get out.